Hi, I'm Jason DeRosso, and this is The Screen Show, your weekly appointment with screen culture on RN. Today, a psychological thriller in a lighthouse starring Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson. I speak to director Robert Eggers about exploring the dark side in the shadow of the big light. Plus, Australian TV comedy Brain, Josh Thomas, has made a follow-up to Please Like Me in LA, and it's called Everything's Gonna Be Okay. The Screen Show's series critic Lauren Carroll Harris and I will be nutting out our first impressions of this show, which is about grief, sexuality, and raising your teenage sisters as a 20-something gay man.
My dad abandoned my mother and I because he got a woman in America pregnant, and then it turns out that daughter has autism, and let's face it, I cannot compete with that.
All that coming up, but first up this week, we're starting the show with some news, and we're going to be handling news a little bit differently, you'll notice, this year, and, well, arguably, one of the biggest news stories unfolding this week is the Sundance Film Festival, which is in full swing. It ends this weekend. And this week, three films directed by Australians have shown there. So we thought we'd get the word on these projects from a critic with her feet on the icy ground. And joining me on the phone now from Sundance is Alison Wilmore, film critic at Vulture. Hello, Alison. Welcome to The Screen Show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, the Midnight Section of Sundance has been a showcase in the past for Australian films. Well, Jennifer Kent's The Babadook, notably, first caught people's attention there and went on to, you know, great acclaim and considerable success. Now another Australian film, I guess, hopes to follow in its footsteps, a film called Relic. Am I wrong to draw comparisons between this new film, Relic, and a film like The Babadook?
No, you're not at all. And in fact, I've seen a few comparisons, both, you know, because they're both Australian horror films, but also because they're films that deal with kind of domestic and family issues through the lens of horror. So I think there's absolutely a lot of similarities there. And they're both they've both been very well received at the festival.
And both directed by women, of course. So this is the debut feature from Natalie Erica James. Now, this film has some American money behind it. The Russo brothers are behind it. It's one of the producers is Jake Gyllenhaal. But it also comes out of the Australian film funding orbit, Screen Victoria. And also it's a benefactor of Screen Australia's Gender Matters initiative. Now, it's got Emily Mortimer in it and Australian actors Robin Nevin and Bella Heathcote. Tell me more about it. It's about Alzheimer's, I believe, but it's kind of through a horror lens.
Yeah, it's a film about three generations of women, and Robin Nevin plays the oldest generation, and she lives by herself, and she disappears, and so her daughter, played by Emily Mortimer, and her granddaughter, played by Bella Heathcote, are summoned back to try and look for her, and they find in the house all of this evidence that maybe her memory is slipping, there are post-its everywhere, you know, and it becomes this kind of terrific, really, horror film about the supernatural, but also the very real fear of watching someone you love slowly slip away while still being in front of you.
Yeah. How's Robin Nevin in the role? Did you know of her before? Because she's quite a legend here of both screen and stage.
Yeah, she wasn't someone I was very familiar with, but she's incredible in the film. You know, she plays someone who is both like feeling very defensive about her independence, but also is kind of slipping in and out of, you know, being there and being present, especially at night. I think she manages to be both deeply sympathetic and also sometimes frightening. You're frightened for her and sometimes of her. She's great.
And do you think, so is this a sort of crossover horror film, a crossover sort of art house horror? I mean, who will it be picked up by, do you think? What's the sense of its sort of commercial prospects?
I think that it's a film where word of mouth is slowly kind of rolling around to boost its profile here at the festival. So there's still more screenings of it. And I can see it getting picked up by a kind of cool indie outlet here. I can see it maybe even being like an A24 or yeah, IFC Films. But I think it is, you know, to your point, in that realm, I know people hate this term, but of elevated horror, you know, it yeah, is, it's very kind of elegantly made and thoughtfully made. It is not necessarily a film that I think the kind of dedicated gore hounds will find all that satisfying necessarily, but
as
I really
gore
appreciated
the
elegant
sophistication. Sure, sure. Yeah, but I take your point.
Too. You know, there's a little bit of that too.
Okay, well, that's Relic. Now, another Australian film, a documentary this time, which is in competition. It's in the World Cinema Documentary Competition. This is called Into the Deep. It's by a director by the name of Emma Sullivan. It's a Netflix film commissioned by Netflix. Now, it's about the Danish submariner who killed a woman journalist on his vessel, then, of course, tried to cover up. I believe started as a straight documentary, more or less about him, from what I can tell, and then, of course, changed course dramatically after the tragedy. Is this one of the most harrowing films you've seen at Sundance? And how well does it manage this shift?
Yeah, you know, it is. It offers a kind of horror in its own way, even though that certainly wasn't its intent going into the film. You can see, and actually Emma Sullivan speaks to this in the film, that she had initially, you know, met Peter Madsen and been kind of just very interested in him as this charismatic figure, as an amateur rocketeer, as someone who has been enlisting the help of, like, you know, passionate volunteers and has this kind of community. So you can see that the initial film she set out to make is one that is kind of, you know, affectionate, that is a tribute to this kind of outsized character. And then obviously that changed a lot, but you know, she approaches that by cutting between the past and then the present of these people in Peter Madsen's circle, discovering the news and grappling with the news as the story unfolds and as it becomes clear that this wasn't an accident, that what it was murder.
And how did they not pick up the signs and so forth? I mean, I'm quite curious about some controversy that's brewing around this film. One of the cinematographers listed on the film, Cam Matheson, has denounced the film, and a Twitter account identifying as one of the interviewees in the film claims that her consent was not given to be included in the documentary. We will obviously keep an eye on this story as it continues to unfold. But I guess putting aside the claims for a moment and these very serious criticisms from people connected to the film, does that surprise you that people who had worked on the film and are featured in the film might have very, very adverse judgments on the finished project, given that it started as something different?
It doesn't surprise me. And I think, you know, one of the things that is both so electric about it and so uncomfortable is that you are watching in this kind of real time as people grapple with these revelations about someone that they had obviously admired and felt very close to. You know, there's one interviewee who just goes from defending Peter Madsen ferociously to slowly starting to feel that he had maybe been looking at her as one of his possible victims. Yes. You know, so these are incredibly difficult, raw emotions. And I think the fact that one of the interviewees possibly wanted to pull her involvement is not, I think, all that surprising when you're watching it. You feel like this film is navigating in some ways that feel a little unprecedented, you know, material and moments that are just incredibly difficult.
Into the Deep, as I say, a Netflix film, so we're going to be seeing it sometime soon, I imagine. Is there a broader theme happening in Sundance? I've read around, you know, various reviews and so forth, and have seen that people, I think you're one of them who sort of has identified a broader theme about truth and the sort of subjective nature of truth that's being explored in various projects at Sundance this year.
Yeah, I would absolutely say that that's a theme. You know, I think in the documentary side, you have Into the Deep, obviously, but also something like there's a documentary about Ren and Stimpy, the animated series, and it clearly started off as a tribute, you know, to the show, and then had to be kind of recut and remade and added to after Me Too allegations came out against the creator of the show. And so you can see it in the film, you know, that it changes as this new information comes out and people give new interviews. I think there's this very, you know, the sense of it as this living document that is being added to, you know, kind of as you're watching it. And certainly on the narrative side as well, to watch something like Zola, you know, which is a film based on a Twitter thread, it's very much a film about what a story is like depending on who gets to tell it. So I think that is a real theme this year throughout many films in the festival.
Yeah. And of course, there's a documentary, I believe, on the Saudi embassy killing as well, the Saudi embassy murder, which I don't know if you've seen, but I imagine would also be a very twisty tale of intrigue, to say the least. Let's move on to finally the third Australian film that's shown at Sundance. Of course, it premiered at the Telluride Festival, I think, last September, but it's at Sundance where it's, you know, making some waves, it's fair to say, given that Sundance was once upon a time really the place where Harvey Weinstein would hold court I'm speaking of The Assistant, a film about gender and abuse that has the Weinstein scandal in its DNA, but it doesn't take a literal approach. It takes a very fictional route, and it's by Kitty Green's first fictional feature, though her very experimental casting, Jo Bonnet, which was a Netflix film, had elements of fiction in it, of course. Tell me about The Assistant and how successful it is in, I guess, speaking to the Weinstein scandal in this very creative way.
Yeah, it's a film about an assistant to a character that we never see, who is the head of a film company, who is clearly meant to be a stand-in for Harvey Weinstein. But the main character is played by Julia Garner, and the film just follows a day in her life. And really, through this lens of this character who has very little power, but is also very kind of central to the workings of this business, you see basically how everyone buys into a culture of power abuse in different ways. And that includes, you know, sexual harassment and certainly and a lot of these stories that we've become very familiar with over the, you know, the year since Me Too. But yeah, it's also about workplace abuse.
Yes, I was going to ask about the very bold point of view, that formal choice that she's made in making this rigorously from this assistant's point of view and never seeing the studio boss or this sort of menacing figure or never seeing him directly. Does that work?
I think it works really well. You know, it's interesting. The filmmaker Leslie Headland, who did things like Sleeping with Other People and the Netflix series Russian Doll, she wrote a play in 2008. She had been a Harvey Weinstein assistant and had worked at the Weinstein Company in Miramax. And she wrote a play called Assistants that is about various assistants working for an unnamed company for an unseen abusive boss.
Yeah.
So it is clearly an idea that I think has occurred to more than one creator. And I think the power of it is just in some ways, someone who's just an abusive person is not as psychologically interesting as all of the other people around that person who have to kind of accommodate that behavior or rationalize it or, you know, endure it. And I think that what this film gets at is that you have to make a lot of psychological adjustments in order to normalize this kind of behavior and decide if you're going to try and stop it and if you can in any way. And, you know, this film, it has a moment where the character tries to go to HR and maybe file a complaint. And I think it's the best scene in the film where you just understand how difficult a choice or how futile it's made to be.
Oh my goodness. I could imagine. all those people who work in HR listening to the show, with all due respect, yes, I could imagine that would be a very nightmarish situation for someone approaching HR with that sort of complaint in that sort of circumstance. Yeah. Well, Alison, all three films, I have to say, are fascinating to me. I can't wait to see them, and hopefully we'll be seeing them on screen sooner rather than later. The Assistant, I know, releases in the US this week or next, and I think it releases at a very opportune moment in the broader culture, given that the Weinstein court case is certainly grabbing headlines. But thank you very much for talking me through those three Australian-directed films at Sundance.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Alison Wilmore, film critic from Vulture. You're listening to The Screen Show.
How long have we been on this rock? 5 weeks? 2 days? Help me to recollect.
Somewhere off the coast of Maine in the late 1800s, two men take up lodgings in a cramped lighthouse. Wikis, they call themselves. The older one, a skinny old coot with a short temper and an appetite for hard liquor, guards his position as chief lighthouse keeper with a miserly pride, while the younger man, who's fresh from a stint working as a lumberjack, is soon bristling at the austere discipline of the job and his partner's overbearing personality. This is the setup for the new film by my next guest, Robert Eggers, a young American filmmaker whose first film, you might remember, The Witch, had a similar eye for oddball and gnarly period detail, not to mention a taste for bizarre rituals in remote communities. The supernatural was very explicit in that film. It's more implicit here in the godlike fury of the ocean and the explosive weather, which is all the more awe-inspiring with Jaron Blaschke's black and white cinematography, not to mention these menacing flocks of seagulls that keep hanging about. But it becomes explicit too as these two very different men come to their inevitable blows. The film evokes the hallucinatory effects of too much solitude, too much hard liquor. And the ultimate female symbol of the high seas, a mermaid, suddenly comes into frame. As a lifeline, perhaps, or maybe like the sirens of ancient myth, something a bit more sinister. Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson play these two grease-covered desperados battling each other as they struggle to keep the lighthouse running. Its relatively flimsy structure of wood, glass, and stone, no match for the elements. Ultimately, though, this is a film about the struggle to maintain psychological equilibrium as much as anything else, and what happens when the human mind is untethered from the bedrock of reason. I'm going to play a clip, and then Robert Eggers coming up.
What do you call that?
Sir?
What?
I mopped and swept twice over,
sir. You lying dog.
Well, I swept them.
Tis begrimed and bedabbled. Unwiped, unwashed, and disdained.
Some kind of pert out of molesting me.
Come now.
I already says...
How dare ye contradict me, you dog?
Now look here. I ain't never intended to be no housewife nor slave in taking this job. And it ain't right. These lodges is more ramshackle than any shanty boys camp I ever seen. The Queen of England's old fancy housekeeper couldn't even done no better than what I done. Because I tell you, I scrubbed this here place twice over.
And I say you did nothing of the sort. And I say, you swab it again, and you swab it proper like this time, and you'll be swabbing it 10 times more after that.
Well, Robert Eggers, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
Now, this film, The Lighthouse, to me recalls a lot of great films that focus really on a tension between two main male characters, and I'm thinking of, you know, Joseph Losey's The Servant or Billy Budd or even Beau Travail, Claire Denis' film. Were these films in any way inspiration for you in getting up The Lighthouse, in writing this film?
The Servant, for sure. And it's funny because Beau Travail was on the brain, not so much for that dynamic, but just, you know, just in sort of the homoeroticism. Obviously, I couldn't shoot things much differently than her, but there is some thought about the way you can photograph men's bodies that certainly comes from Claire Denis' work.
It's interesting, from the very get-go, we have a sense of the bodily functions and the bodily, well, and as the film progresses, bodily desires and so forth. These are two men isolated. I quite enjoyed that. It was quite confronting at first to sort of think, oh wow, he's going to go there. These are two guys alone on a rock and he's going to go there. But you did. Tell me a little bit more about that sort of notion of the physicality and the claustrophobia of two men alone and the isolation, of course.
Yeah, I mean, my sort of go-to line is nothing good happens when two men are trapped in a giant phallus. And so, yeah, I mean, in these close quarters, it's all going to come out. And every excretion that can come from a biologically male body is included in the movie. My apologies to everyone, but that's, you know, that's what it's about. And certainly when I was working in the dregs of the New York City indie film world, I was often forced to sleep in shared quarters with flatulent coworkers that, you know, I wouldn't have chosen to be my roommate, much less my like single roommate. So, you know, what can I tell you? These tensions arise naturally in that situation.
Well, Willem Dafoe's character is, from what you're saying, he's a wonderful character, very grotesque. Reminded me a little bit of that, and I can't remember his name, but you know the character in L'Atelant, Jean Vigo's film, and he's a kind of sea dog, and he lives on that very grotesque character. He kind of reminded me a little bit of that. And from what you're saying, I'm thinking that his character perhaps came first in your mind. Is that how the script developed?
I think that there's a way in which the finished version, as like of Robert Pattinson's character, must be a little bit unattainable and a little bit of a cipher, because he doesn't know who he is, and that's part of what the whole movie's about.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, like, on a very surface level, Willem's character is like a salty sea dog archetype. You know, you mentioned Jean Vigo, but you could also mention The Simpsons or Peppa Pig. I mean, it's that, like, close to cartoon had it not been played by Willem Dafoe. I mean, his dialect is incredibly researched by me and my brother, and we can, you know, we have the books and references to show someone that, like, we believe that this dialect existed, but, you know, it sounds like a pirate. And so yes, he was something that was very grounding for us when we were writing, and it took more time to find Rob's character. And in fact, when the scenes are being performed, I would say that Willem did a 1,000% better version than exactly of what I had exactly pictured in my mind. And I'd say, you know, a third of the time, Rob did things that were different than my preconceived notions about the character's behavior.
I mean, he's a wonderful actor, Robert Pattinson. I mean, he's doing, in some ways, correct me if I'm wrong, but I my impression is he's almost doing the opposite in performance terms to what Defoe's doing a lot of the time. Defoe's kind of very expressive and external, and a lot of what works or what needs to work with Pattinson's character is that he's kind of internal, and there's a lot of mystery there and a lot of stuff beneath the surface.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, Willem is go, 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 and goad, 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 goad. And, it, you know, we're watching Rob mostly be silent as Defoe berates him or bores him with monologues and so forth. And when can he, like, not take it any longer? And when is this guy finally going to burst? I mean, I don't think I'm spoiling anything by saying that. The plot of this movie is incredibly thin and survives on atmosphere and performance. It's, you know, this isn't a great sell, but it's kind of the same scene over and over and over again.
Well, it's a pressure cooker, but then it increments, and you've got various moments, though, where things kind of go next level, I suppose. I mean, it almost reminds me of an office drama as well. I mean, this
sure
could be a kind of allegory for a kind of very eager and ambitious millennial coworker who really wants the top job and is kind of very jealous and resentful of a tyrannical kind of, I don't know, baby boomer boss. I really am loath to talk in generalist terms about generations, but it strikes me that there's this intergenerational angst there too. Was that always there in your idea, or did that sort of come up when sort of Rob, you know, you were sort of casting these characters with such sort of different ages? Or was that, or was the age thing always important?
The age thing, it was important. In fact, I mean, this was partly a function of not confusing the reader, but because we don't know, like, the characters' names until a third of the way through the film, and then one of the characters' names changes. For clarity's sake, in the screenplay, the characters were called Young and Old. So that, for the reader, also makes you very aware of those themes as you're reading the screenplay. So Rob and Willem and the whole cast, you know, the whole crew, I guess there's a few more cast members, but everyone's very aware of that dynamic because of that. And in fact, all through filming and all through post-production, they were always referred to as old and young by me and everyone, including themselves. And it was only sort of doing press that we had to, like, rehabilitate their characters' names, though generally I just called them Rob and Willem. But funnily enough, when this movie was leaked to the press before we shot it, it said that it starred Willem Dafoe as a lighthouse keeper named Old. So,
but how front of center was it? I mean, how front of mind was it for you? Did you want this to be about an intergenerational, you know, generational archetypes and that kind of tension between them?
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, that was central, though.
Yeah.
I mean, or was it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, the one of the source. The main source for the plot comes from Wales in 1801. It's often referred to as the Small's Lighthouse Tragedy. Two lighthouse keepers one older, one younger, both named Thomas, were marooned at their lighthouse station during a storm. The old one died. The young one went mad, and you know that's our movie.
Yeah.
And the fact that they were both named Thomas, young and old, that made me think, okay, like this can be a two-hander about identity and what is the old and young thing. I mean, there was a version of the script that was terrible. Early on that my brother and I had that finishes with, you know, Rob Pattinson with a huge beard sort of putting on Willem Dafoe's uniform, you know? So yes, all that was there.
How many drafts did you go through? And when you say terrible, I mean, I think a lot of people would be very pleased to hear you say that because it makes you sound very relatable, I'm sure, to a lot of people listening who write themselves. And tell me about that process. How long was it? How many drafts did you write? Were there moments where you thought it's never going to work?
For some reason with this story, I've never felt that it wasn't going to work. Even when we didn't have a story, even when it was like draft after draft, outline after outline, in the opposite order of garbage, for some reason I believed in this in a way that I haven't completely believed in anything else I've written. I don't know.
Including
why.
The witch.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And why? What was it about this that had? What was the core of it that was so strong?
I couldn't tell you. It was really, you know, it was after. Like, I mean, I know that like we're swinging for the fences. The film is grotesque and perverse and over the top and indulgent and mad. And I knew that, but it wasn't until we sort of finally finished the movie, the whole thing, color correct, everything, or grade, because there's no color. And I realized, like, wow, like, who in the hell's going to like this thing? You know? But, you know, you do, I think, it's not, like, you have to question your work. You can't just think, you have to have enough ego strength to, like, keep going. But if you are thinking everything you're doing is great, then you're not going to be able to push yourself to do something that's of any worth. You know, then you're going to be comfortable and not evolving as someone who makes creative work. So you have to look at what you're doing as crap. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, for sure. I mean, I wonder, does your brother help you there? I mean, working with your brother, is that beneficial, or you know, are you beneficial to his process? I mean, are you both able to be a little bit more full frontal and not pull any punches when you deliver criticisms?
Oh yeah, I mean, I demand that from all my collaborators, but it's very easy with me and my brother because there's a lot of history there, and no one's feelings get too hurt because we're brothers, you know?
Yeah,
so that is nice. But I think, I mean, I know that, there are certain things that that I thought were really stupid that my brother wanted in the script and he was absolutely right. And I know.
Like what? Tell me.
Well, I didn't want the seagulls to be major characters in the film, because I knew it was going to be difficult to photograph.
You with your director's hat on are like, no way. And yeah. He's like, no. The seagulls are great.
They're
very sinister.
Great. Yes, and we did find very well-trained seagulls, and so all was well. But no, I kind of refused to read the scenes that he had written about the seagulls, and then he just said, "You like stop being an asshole and read them." So I don't know if I can say that on your show.
You
Sorry.
Can say that, yeah.
And then I know my brother hated the last image of the movie until it was kind of done. He thought it was really heavy-handed. I mean, he's right. It is really heavy-handed.
It's full of a kind of a certain Catholic grotesque sure. Medieval weight to it, I suppose. I could imagine how it might be divisive, but I think it works. Can I ask you a final question? Who fought the fight to have it in this ratio, this frame shape, and black and white?
I wouldn't say that it was easy, but you know, it was certainly my intention from the beginning, and me and my DP and Jaren and the creative producer Jay Van Hoy were all committed to making it work. And I honestly, it took like 2 days of conversation, and then, you know, RT Features, A24, New Regency were all incredibly supportive. I mean, look, this film got made this way. It's like the whole thing is shocking. So they were incredibly supportive.
But do you think it says something about things need to be distinctive if they're going to be kind of swinging for the fences and be a little different? They've got to be distinctive. I mean, do you think there's almost more latitude now for people to kind of, directors to and auteurs to sort of try something a little different visually? I mean, we're in an age where people are looking at images all the time. Perhaps it's easier now than it might have been 10 years ago.
I think so. I think also as long as you can stand under the umbrella of genre, then I think financiers and distributors are more willing to take a risk because they have a little bit of safety and financial safety in the idea that it's genre. I think if this weren't horror adjacent and didn't have mermaids and Lovecraftian tentacles, I think it wouldn't have happened. But that's okay because I like all that stuff.
Yeah, sure. And without Jay Van Hoy, it's interesting you said, I've got a friend who's a creative producer, and they always remind me, you are too auteurist. You have to give credit to creative producers. And Jay Van Hoy, I'm glad you did. You mentioned that you're a creative producer, and they're important for especially younger auteurs, aren't they? That I don't know if
yeah,
you consider yourself an auteur, but do you know what I mean?
You need to have people fighting for you and who understand what you're trying to do. And I mean, I've gotten better at it over the years. You know, this is the hero. This is the villain. This is the monster. This is the love interest. Like, you know, I hate talking like that, but I know how to now. But sometimes you do need people who are better at talking that way to interpret like what you're doing to what you're trying to do to people who are more interested in coin and returns and spreadsheets, you know.
Robert Eggers, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Same here.
Yeah, director and co-writer of The Lighthouse, Robert Eggers. He was a pleasure. The Lighthouse is up for a cinematography Oscar, by the way. Certainly well-deserved. That aspect ratio I spoke about, it's kind of squarish. And I don't know how to say it, but I can read it. I'm reading it off the screen. 119.1 is what it's called. Cinematographer Jaron Blaschke. I'm mindful with this film, though, that, look, on reflection, it is one of those films where it's beautiful to look at. I wonder if the style does eclipse the thematic content. It's incredibly evocative, but perhaps struggles to get into third gear in the interrogation of these two men and their twisted emotional lives. Maybe go and check it out. It releases this week. You can make up your own mind. Limited, and then it releases wider next week. It's called The Lighthouse. Okay, you're listening to The Screen Show on RN. My name's Jason DeRosso. Now for something completely different. And now it's time to move to the small screen with our resident critic, Lauren Carol Harris. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Jason.
Talking about a new show from a beloved Australian creator by the name of Josh Thomas.
Yeah, he's got a new comedy, maybe even dramedy on
yes.
Stan.
It's called, now I'm looking forward to this discussion because this is a show I'm completely undecided about. I've only seen three episodes. We've only been allowed to see three episodes of this show called Everything's Going to Be Okay, which is on Stan.
And like Please Like Me, his first show, Josh Thomas plays a version of himself. This time he's a 20-something Australian. He becomes the guardian of his teenage American half-sisters after their father dies of quote-unquote very bad cancer.
Yeah,
I'm sorry
to see him go. I wonder if he'll come back as a ghost or
he's
something later
presence.
On. He's a good presence. But it was a weird, yes, it was quote-unquote, I have a very bad cancer.
And so Josh Thomas finds himself parenting two teen girls when really they're all, you know, quirky orphans raising each other in an unconventional family unit while he's dealing with his own kind of made-up first world problems, I guess you'd say. I've got a clip of this idea of Josh Thomas being not quite a father and not quite a brother in this new show.
I don't have alcohol in here. You can't take that.
Pinch schnapps. Nothing's changed.
It's not mine.
Oh, honey. Honey. We don't care that you brought alcohol, like, really. I mean, do we care? Okay, yeah, I mean, teenage drinking, it's bad. It's fun.
I mean, undeniably fun.
Undeniably, gosh.
Fun. Good
but
days.
You're not allowed to do it because your brain is still going through several maturation processes,
cool.
which makes it more susceptible to damage from things like peach schnapps.
Is that true?
Yes, Bob. It's true. I'm an entomologist and he's a dentist. Okay, we're authorities on facts. Mm-hmm. Also, I don't want to get in trouble by your mum. So, that's it.
I thought you were supposed to be cool.
Me?
I told you that.
Yeah, I'm cool.
Your torso's too long.
Oh my God, she's right. She's absolutely right. How did she know that? I'm all torso.
Okay, can you go now?
Want us to go? Where?
Anywhere else.
Okay.
Okay, so there's Josh Thomas grappling with these new responsibilities as guardian of these two teenage girls. Let's talk a little bit more before we get into the show. Talk a little bit more about our impressions of what this means for his career. This is very interesting. I mean, he's essentially been plucked from Australia and here he is making a show in America for an American cable network.
And yet it still feels very him. It still feels like a very Josh Thomas-y show. He's the writer. He's the creator. He's in it. So he's all over it. I just find it so interesting because his first show, Please Like Me, was so skillful, so silly and sharp and tender and heartbreaking. And, you know, he's a great writer. He's a very character-driven writer. So now...
And that was about... Just to, for those who didn't see it, I mean, it was quite a phenomenon. It was about a share house.
Yeah, it was about young people grappling with growing up, their sexual identities, and Josh Thomas's mother in the show had serious mental illnesses.
Yeah.
So it was all about that emotional messiness in young life. And so now, yeah, it's like he's been put through the US TV industry's sitcom machine. And, you know, I feel the US industry is great at writing and producing these shows. They've got the blueprint down. So it's really interesting to see that he's got a real formula. Each episode has a structure whereby Josh Thomas's character, who is like him, you know, kind of funny and needy and really camp, encounters a parenting problem with these intense, you know, neurotic teenage girls. He muddles through the conflict and then there's a really nice inevitable conclusion. So there's this semi-dark premise of their father's death that leads to growth and this sunny, warm, bubbly kind of vibe.
Well, it is a show about life and death, isn't it? That then kind of puts that through a comedic filter, whereas Please Like Me, though I didn't watch it as much as you, tended to be almost the opposite. It was a show about perhaps some smaller issues in some ways when it dealt with the 20-somethings, but kind of put it through.
I think it was a more melancholic show, mm-hmm. and now everything's going to be okay. Well, it's in the title, isn't it? And it's a very LA show,
okay.
I got to say.
Okay. Where in LA is this? This is a sumptuous, it's a beautiful backdrop.
It's up in some kind of valley. It's a rich part of LA above that kind of hot, like...
That hot plane.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And... That's something that irks me about how his writing has absorbed some of these very American conventions on TV. Like, it's set in this outrageously massive, aspirational mansion. And Please Like Me was quite aware of the fact, I think, that it was about pretty privileged white middle-class Australian nudes. It was a bit like Seinfeld in that it put really banal problems on a life and death level. And it was self-satirizing. That was what was self-satirizing about it. But what irks me about Everything's Going to Be Okay is that there doesn't seem to be that self-awareness yet. It's just kind of this magazine-style palace.
Well, not
that's
yet.
Never,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
not commented on yet. I
not
hope
yet.
That is.
It's,
because
it's interesting, isn't it? Because it seems like a show that at a certain point will need to check its privilege to use the term a little bit, right? Because it is, I mean, I like what I see on screen. I think it's eye candy for people interested in whatever interior design.
In renovations,
it's a beautiful sort of sumptuous.
But there's something about that sumptuous
renovation shows.
Yeah, go on. Something about that design and setting undercuts the need for this show to be relatable and have relatable characters, which is kind of what it's all about.
Aspirational is what you sort of said earlier, and that's, yes, it's on that fine line between aspirational and a bit alienating perhaps for some people.
That's right.
Because it is in some ways unrelatable, as you say, but it's this fantasy and I'm not quite sure it's heading with that fantasy yet. I mean, yes, he has made a very LA show. And let's talk about the two young female actors who play
these
half-sisters. I think, or one sister and one half-sister. They're superb. And their friends are superb. I mean, this is a show of girls in the teenage years is actually really funny and very endearing. I mean, they're so well cast.
And even though Josh Thomas can be a bit solipsistic, a bit self-involved, there's a real generosity here, I think.
Because, in the way he's sharing the stage?
Yes, and he said that he just wanted to write a show where he got to riff off teen girls because he just thinks teen girls are cool and smart and funny and irreverent. And, you know, I think that's a great thing about the show that it does really well. Like, their world is quite real. It's as real as his world. And
maybe realer, yes, dare I say. I really think it's where the show shines. Whereas, as the high school drama. Yeah. And yeah, go on.
His character is the least developed of all of them. It feels like he's a little bit stuck on the persona that he developed in Please Like Me. And the other really big deal about this show is that it features a teenager with autism playing a teenager with autism. Her name is Matilda. And I just thought, not only is this pretty unique in TV storytelling, the show does it really well. Matilda is on the spectrum, and I really like how her autism plays out in the context of a holistic character who has all these funny little traits, you know, beyond her neuroatypical status. But it also plays it for laughs, which in a really,
it's got
like
the courage to do that, you mean?
Yes, exactly. Mm. Even though she's as much defined by, you know, the awkwardness of her teen girldom and, you know, the cruelties of puberty, there's some really great moments where the humour is really boldly and irreverently mind with her autistic status. I'd really like you to hear this clip of how Matilda very studiously navigates dating.
You can't just ask a random stranger out. Why? Well, how could he know if he likes you if he's never met you? I know he might say no, and it will hurt my feelings, but to find love, you have to make yourself vulnerable.
Matilda, please. You have to, flirt with him? Do you even know how to flirt?
You're supposed to ask questions about themselves and pretend that they're smarter than you. Did you see that on YouTube?
Yes!
Yeah, that was Kayla Cromer. We were hearing from there the autistic actor playing this autistic character, Matilda, in Everything's Going to Be Okay, which is Josh Thomas's new show screening on Stan in Australia. We mentioned before, it's very much his thing. I mean, there are a couple of co-writers on the second episode, I think. He's not listed as a director on any of the episodes yet.
That's right.
But nevertheless, it's creator. He's on screen. Where do we place his humour, do you think, within that broader tradition of, I guess, great satirical self-deprecating memoir auteurists like, Curb Your Enthusiasm, you know, Larry David, Woody Allen, Lena Dunham, perhaps, the Broad City women. I mean, I noticed that the director of photography on this used to work on Broad City.
There is a real overlap, isn't there? I mean, he's like Woody Allen and those neurotic men on screen, and he's not. He's making autobiographical stories and projecting a version of himself. I mean, when you think about Woody's body of work, it is about artistry and neurosis, but it's also, I think, about morality and marriage, to be honest, you know, mm-hmm. lies and just self-deceptions around relationships and the destruction of relationships and, frankly, guilt around cheating and ruining relationships with women. But I think Josh Thomas, he's more on the line of Ryan O'Connell, whose sitcom special we talked about last year. And, you know, even Donald Glover or even Ellen DeGeneres in the 90s. I think that, you know, this might sound funny, but I think Josh Thomas is kind of like how Lena Dunham sees herself or wants to be like, but she has such like cursed rich white woman energy that she can't really self-satirize. But Josh Thomas's theme,
I think she's a talent though, I will say. I think Girls was at times reached some great heights, but sorry,
at times. I think they share a theme, which is growing up and being forced into adulthood,
right,
almost against your will. So these millennial neurotics who dig into their nerviness and their narcissism with a bit of self-awareness and who have youths that are filled with kind of weird ambition and self-sabotage and even like sexual frustration and this need to be liked, and, you know, this sense of queer sexual identity that you define for yourself. But I can sense that, Jason, maybe you think his humor is a bit too narcissistic.
There is a narcissistic streak, I guess, that's what I perceive in Josh Thomas that I'm not quite comfortable with. And that his considerable charisma doesn't quite counterbalance for me quite. I mean, I think you're right in saying, you said earlier, this is quite a generous show in the way that he's sharing the stage or the screen with these two teenage girls. And I think that's very true. And I think there is a warmth, it's a real warm-heartedness to this.
That's right.
My jury's out because I'm just not sure if this is self-aware enough yet. And I don't know whether, something I said earlier, I'm not sure if this show needs to check its privilege. I mean, surely that's where it's heading.
Surely. And I think also, whether you like this show or not, just comes down to whether you like Josh Thomas or not. Like, he's a weird unit. Like,
he's a weird unit.
And I say that
accent,
in a nice way.
Even the accent.
Like, why does he talk like that? Perth. He comes from Perth.
Is he from Perth?
Yes.
Right. I mean, it's this kind of strange, it's undoubtedly a little, I suppose we could say fairly it's camp,
yeah.
But there's this weird mid-Atlantic thing happening from someone from the Indian Ocean.
He's a very odd individual. Kind of he looks like an elderly baby,
I do like his look. He's got a great face for television because it's a very interesting
face.
And
he has a gift for really kooky dialogue. He's very skilled at getting these mundane situations down in a funny way. And he does dip into quite benevolent nihilism, I guess you'd say, and bruising heartbreak.
Yes.
But then he comes back up into that warmth and that kindness and that humanness. So I find him lovable.
And he can look like a very old pink-skinned man. He has a face that has a lot of character in it for someone so young. And I think that works incredibly in his favour. The other thing I've got a problem with in this show so far, and again, only three eps in, because that's all we can see, but I don't believe the parenting thing. This is a guy that, even if you can say this is the honeymoon period just after the father's died and they're all getting along.
Yeah, he giddily leaps into guardianship.
He leaps into it. I can't see the pressures and responsibilities of daily parenting weighing down on this character in a believable way. Maybe that's to come.
Yeah, what's happening is that it doesn't have the emotional depth. I mean, Please Like Me took a few seasons to really get to that bittersweet undercurrent of damaged souls finding their own family, like a queer family. And that's what put it on par with comedies that are as good as dramas, right?
And it was really celebrated. I mean, really was received very well, that show.
Didn't it?
I mean, it was one of those Australian shows that really...
internationally recognised. I do hope that everything's going to be okay, has the confidence to go into these uncomfortable places. Maybe it's just setting up a more jolly... premise.
I know what you mean. Teenage girls, hello.
Exactly.
It's a difficult period.
Exactly.
There are difficult issues.
Yeah.
I don't even believe, in a way, I don't even believe the premise of the show that he would be asked as he's supposed to be a 20-something kind of guy, hasn't had much sort of history with these girls. I don't even believe that he'd be asked. But given that that's the premise, you go, okay,
he's so
fine.
Irresponsible. Yeah, no.
But, given the premise, it's fine. But I think it needs to find a bit of a rock bottom kind of bedrock of reality somewhere in the series.
Nice,
hopefully that's where it's headed.
No, I think I'm going to hang in there and see if it ripens and fully leans into the pathos of its premise, because it hasn't struck that perfect happy, sad tone yet at all. And if it does, then it could be a great comedy.
Yeah, and it's got some great things about it, and especially these co-stars.
I'm with you on that one.
These two girls, Maeve Press and Kayla Cromer. Lauren Carroll Harris, great to be with you again.
Thanks, Jason.
In this new year, discussing more small screen stuff. And this is a really interesting first salvo for the year, I guess. It's everything's going to be okay.
Isn't
okay
it?
Spelled OKAY. Is it really? Who knows? Maybe it's not, but we like to think so. Thanks, Lauren.
See ya.
And it's screening on Stan. That's Lauren Carroll Harris, our series critic here on The Screen Show on RN.
A million Americans look at you and they see an escape.
This country is at war with itself.
She has a history of donations to civil rights groups. She's a sympathizer, sir.
Hello? Hello? You've tapped our phones. I think it's the government.
Our job is to cheapen our image in the eyes of the public.
There's things that I've been ordered to do.
Those are pictures from her bedroom.
They're pushing her too hard.
Saber, you gotta stop. They will destroy you.
Who is it?
A woman has her secrets.
Yeah, it sounds like a thriller, doesn't it? And in many ways it is. That's the new film called Seaberg, which is directed by Iceland-based Australian theatre director, poet, and more recently, of course, filmmaker Benedict Andrews, about Jean Seaberg, starring Kristen Stewart, as I said, titled simply Seaberg. It's a stylish, but I have got to say too often, trite depiction of the actor. Perhaps most, not most well-known, but certainly made famous and most renowned for her role in Jean-Luc Godard's groundbreaking debut, Breathless. But this film mostly focuses on her return to America in the 1960s with her French husband, who here is played by Ivan Attal, who's looking like his gate crash from a much better movie, I must say. And it's about her involvement with radical politics and the Black Panther movement, which drew a lot of attention from the FBI at the time. Now, this has a script by Joe Shrapnel and Anna Waterhouse. Now, their previous credits include the Cold War thriller Aftermath, which I didn't see, and I also didn't see their Jesse Owens biopic titled dubiously Race. Works on two levels. I think Andrews is up against it, basically, making anything meaningful from this script. He tries and tries, though, as does Stewart, who steps out of her mesmerizing, if narrow, trademark range of a very watchable tics and quirks to play a woman much more confident and powerful than usual. Andrews begins the film with a statement of intent that's very promising. It's a bravura sequence where we see her reflection in the lens of a movie camera. It's Otto Preminger's lens. And that segues into the fateful moment on the set of Preminger's film that discovered her, about Joan of Arc, where she's very badly burned in the execution scene. In that sequence, let me tell you, I was thinking the elements of tragedy, feminism, and the movies, they're all here. I was thinking I was in for a rich psychological drama expressed via images, but I was soon floundering in much more banal stuff and a bizarre double barrel storyline, disappointingly, that sees Stewart share screen time with a square-jawed Jack O'Connell, who's playing an FBI agent from the suburbs who's been sent to tail Seaberg. And we learn in turn, in part via some domestic woes on the home front, that the times they are a-changing, even for him, even for guys with buzz cuts and shirt sleeves in the suburbs. Why, oh why? Seaberg's affair with Black Panther activist Hakeem Jamal, played by Anthony Mackie, is established with perfunctory plotting, offers no revelatory glimpses into the politics of the era or the movement. His wife, played by Zazie Beetz, is paid only passing interest. Stewart is captivating, as usual, though a tussled, cropped blonde hairdo is not really enough to make her truly resemble Seaberg, and a series of slinky costumes designed to reflect the sunny, groovy, and sexy LA of the mid-60s does tend to push her into a slightly fetishistic register, almost like a Tarantino movie. I think given the tragic end to Seaberg's life, this accumulation of dud notes does amount to a real missed opportunity. I mean, what of the 1960s and its radical politics did Andrews hope to convey, critique, or commemorate in this conventionally minded thriller? What of this woman from Middle America and her life-changing encounters, positive and negative, with some of the great artists and thinkers of her time? There is less here than meets the eye. If you want to see a great film about Jean Seaberg, Google Jean Seaberg and Mark Rappaport. You can find his film made in the mid-90s from the journals of Jean Seaberg around on the internet. You can check that out for free. Yes, it's a pity because Benedict Andrews, his first film, which came out a couple of years ago called Una, wasn't bad. It was about a young woman tracking down her abuser. Okay, well, that's all I have to say on that. Seaberg is out this week. That is it from me. You can hear me, Jason DeRosso, and Lauren Carroll Harris back next week, same place, same time, on a fresh edition of The Screen Show. We'll go out with some music from the soundtrack of Seaberg, composed by Jed Kurzel.